Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. Now let's get on with the show. Our guests today will be Jason Sigger and Jim Carafano to discuss our little Halloween-y topic we picked for today. As those that have saw our little lead into the show online, you know, when you hear about an electromagnetic pulse attack, a lot of people have the initial reaction of, what are you talking about? Either that, or people will get fidgety and you'll get these weird doomsday scenarios, or some people just roll their eyes and they don't really care one way or another. If you're an old cold warrior, though, the topic and the subject of electromagnetic pulse and mitigation and trying to find a way to fight through it is an old topic. Something that we used to spend a lot of time on back when we were worrying about operating in a nuclear environment. But since 9/11, as everybody has put on their fancy red hats and have tried to look at different ways that we could be nicked by an adversary, it's come on more and more. For the first half of the hour, I'm real happy to tell you our first guest is Jason. He is a defense analyst from the Washington, D.C. area. He is also a former Army chemical officer before he became a consultant in the mid-1990s. Jason Sigger's specialty is chemical and biological defense issue. He also runs a blog called The Armchair Generalist. So if you like what Jason says or you'd like to have him flesh out some other topics, I would highly encourage you to go over there, Google Armchair Generalist, find your way there and read some of what Jason's putting out there for you to ponder. He also likes to say that he discusses military issues from what he describes as a progressive point of view. So, Jason, welcome aboard to Midrats.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Real happy to say, I want to give you something that is uncharacteristically a short and direct question coming from me. For our listeners, tell us, what is EMP? And right now, what is going right in the conversations that people are having about it? And where are people kind of getting it wrong?
Okay, well, electromagnetic pulse is an effect that we see from a nuclear blast in general. There is a way to make a non-nuclear EMP effect that you might have seen in Ocean's 11, but that was kind of the fictional version. But essentially, whenever you have a nuclear detonation, we have what we call nuclear weapons effects. And that includes, of course, blast, heat, radiation, and the EMP effect. EMP is basically just a large surge of electricity that goes through the atmosphere and can cause disruption to your communications and other sensitive electronic equipment. We've known about this EMP effect since 1962 when we were doing nuclear weapons tests out in the Pacific, and they noticed the lights flickering a little bit in Hawaii, hundreds of miles away. So we started looking into this threat more, since everybody had thought, well, we're going to go up against the Soviets and we're going to have a nuclear war. We better make sure our equipment can roll through a nuclear blast and keep on ticking. So there's been a lot of work in nuclear hardening for communications, not just for aircraft and satellites, but also communication gear, tanks, anything that had electronics used to have hardening built into them. Not so much for the homeland, but for the military. The military understood this art and had put a lot of money and energy into it. When the Cold War ended in 1990-92, depending on when you count it, the money behind electromagnetic pulse hardening dried up as well. That's led to a number of defense science board and other commissions looking at this and saying, have we gone too far? Do we need to bring EMP back into the system and make our equipment survivable from this electronic pulse? Now, the thing that I want to make clear is we understand EMP is a technical effect. We understand it exists. People that are critical of the EMP commission, per se, are sometimes accused of not believing that the effect could happen. And so, no, of course, it's a scientific effect. We got it. If a nuke goes off, it's going to have an EMP pulse associated with it, and that's going to be a problem with our communications, especially if it's over the United States. Nobody argues with that. Everybody understands that our nuclear weapons silos need to be hardened since they're going to be targeted by nuclear weapons. Our satellites need to be hardened in case somebody tries to pop a nuke in space and wipe out our ability to watch them from the high skies. Nobody argues with that. We're all on it. We're all understanding. It's just a matter of getting into the budget, getting into R&D, and making sure that the industry has the right standards and the right testing. And all that can go on quite easily. Where we disagree is, what's the terrorist's ability to use this same threat? And it all goes back to this point of believing that you think a terrorist can either obtain a nuclear weapon or build one and then get it on a missile, bring it over to the United States without detection, and blast it off over the coast, or ideally from Kansas, to the altitude of hundreds of miles into the air, and then blow this thing up, instead of just bringing the nuke into the Boston Harbor or New York or Los Angeles and knocking out a city. They say, oh no, the terrorists are much more smarter than that. They want to knock out the United States, so therefore we need to be able to knock down the terrorist missile that's going up over the United States. Or if you want to say North Korea or Iran's going to pop a nuke, or China, the thing that we need to be careful about is saying, is it a state doing it or is it a terrorist doing it? If a state's doing it, they're taking the chance that if an EMP ball, if you see a missile coming up over the coast and it pops over the United States, we're going to figure out where that missile came from. And if it came from a state, they're going to get a nuclear response in return. If the terrorists, yes, of course, that's going to be a little bit more problematic. But the odds of having a terrorist bring that nuclear device over and wanting to pop it just to cause an EMP effect has to be questioned a little bit. The bottom line is, when you look at all the possible hazards that a terrorist could bring to the United States, we have a limited amount of resources in terms of people and money. Where are you going to put your money? Is it going to be with a missile defense system that's aimed at that one in a trillion chance that a terrorist is bringing over a megaton device on a nuclear, on a missile? Or are you going to spend that money elsewhere, like going and getting them overseas? That's basically our concern when we talk about this EMP challenge.
When we talk about the possibility of a terrorist attack using a weapon like this, and you have to go through all the hoops, but let's assume they get a hold of a nuke, and then if the nuke is small enough that it can be put on a warhead, and then they have some way of getting the warhead here. Now, there have been a couple of recent developments where I think some company in Russia has developed this club missile in a container, shipping container. Is there any, what's your view of what the risk of that sort of somebody buying one of those, using it for terrorist purposes, and getting it close enough where they can send it up something like that up above Boston or Washington D.C. and then when you have to send it up, it has to be timed right so that it blows up the right altitude and all that stuff. I mean, are you saying that's just such a low risk that that is not the major threat?
Pretty much. I saw that video. I thought it was a great piece of marketing. The way they showed that device attacking what was clearly U.S. or NATO forces, not that they were trying to create a certain image or anything, but certainly it's probable. If you've got a terrorist group with billions of dollars that can buy that kind of technology without the intelligence community finding out, given our global economics, our global transportation lines, the number of cargo ships that come to the United States, sure, it's within the realm of probability. It's a very small probability. It counts on a lot of things to go the terrorist way before they would be successful in that kind of an event. I think about 2 years ago, I think the associate director of the FBI's WMD directorate, he came to NDU to talk about what they do to combat terrorist WMD efforts. And he pointed out two things. He said, first of all, we're not just sitting in the United States. We're overseas. We're working with other countries. They were there on Mumbai. They were there in every major city trying to make sure that they're on top of intelligence situations, working with the law enforcement agents in those countries. The thing he said that impressed me, he said, you often hear this thing about a terrorist only has to be lucky once. He says, that's not true at all. He says, he had said, the more complex a scenario gets, the more players that he has to involve, the easier it is for this guy to get caught. And the law enforcement people only have to be lucky once. They only have to bust that chain from the source of the munition to getting it to the United States once, and they've stopped the crime from occurring. In this case, you talk about the scenario with the Russian cargo ship missile. Okay, they've got to get the dealer. They've got to buy the munition. They've got to have somebody who knows how to work the controls. They have to have somebody with the nuclear munition to put it on it. They've got to get the ship and the captain to take it to the United States, and they've got to hope that it doesn't get interdicted on the way. That those are a lot of chains that have to happen all at the same time without them getting caught. And the FBI point of view was that's where we're going to catch them, is because as they try to create these WMD type scenarios, these large mass casualty scenarios, you bring more and more people into their plans, and somebody's going to talk, and word is going to get out. Now, you may say this is optimistic, and I say, okay, here's the difference between myself and Mr. Carafano and the Heritage Foundation. What the Heritage Foundation wants to do is build a national missile defense to stop this situation from happening. Now, just taking a look at what we're doing in Poland and the Czech Republic for the Iran scenario, we're spending up to $2 billion per site to set up a missile intercept and a radar station. Okay, what do we have to do for the United States? We're going to have to put a missile defense system, at least one, in every state, because no congressman is going to allow their state not to have a missile defense system. California, Texas, Alaska, they're probably going to have two each. Do the math. We're talking hundreds of billions of dollars just to set this up and operate it, waiting for that terrorist to show up with his missile on the boat. Or we could take a look at the number of countries that are capable of building a megaton nuclear device, because that's what you would need, megaton, not just a kiloton. And we've got, I think there's, seven nuclear countries right now, with two on the edge. A couple of those are friendlies, so we can probably write those off, but not necessarily. But we're basically worried about Russia, China, Pakistan, and North Korea. Here's a finite number of countries where we ought to be pouring money, advice, and, well, maybe not Iran and North Korea.
Yeah.
It seems that a lot of people's concerns is Pakistan. So the point is, go after the nukes at the source rather than waiting for the nukes to come to us.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you on two points. I think for a lot of the ideas that people have about, you know, defending on a macro scale this theoretical threat, you know, two things are working against it. One is post-impact weapons forensics. We'll find out where it comes from. And also, there's just the cost issue. It's a huge cost issue. And that's one thing where I've seen it pop up a fair bit, and I wanted to toss it to you this way, and you've touched on it a little bit at this point. When it comes to addressing the threat, however small it is and where it is when you rack and stack it on possible threats to this country, but when we're talking about EMP, has it become similar to ballistic missile defense where it's become a political issue? Or is there a part of this where there is a bipartisan national defense consensus on how we should try to mitigate this?
That's a good question. There was an EMP commission, which I'm sure Mr. Carafano will quote, that was, how long ago did they do their thing? Back in 2004, and another follow-up in 2008. Where they said, we believe there's an EMP, possibility of an EMP threat, and we ought to do something to harden our, to avoid compromising that capability. And everybody said, yeah, we all agree. The bipartisan part was, we acknowledge that there's a vulnerability and we should address this. But they really don't go much farther than that. I think the challenge has been they take a look at our communications framework, our infrastructure, and say it's really kind of large. What do we have to do to harden that? Maybe there are some critical points in the infrastructure where we can harden it against an impact from a EMP and bring in these transformers that supposedly would be needed to replace the dead ones that got fried. Unfortunately, these large transformers aren't made in the United States anymore, so we'd have to order them from overseas and stockpile it. I don't think anybody would have a problem with that. It's just that nobody's come up with a plan or a bottom line cost of what it would take to harden our power grid. So we have a second group. There's been a number, well, you've seen the USA Today paper where there have been a number of studies on solar flares saying if there's a solar storm, basically, it could create the same kind of EMP effect and either temporarily knock out or permanently knock out parts of our communications infrastructure. That's a little less partisan. And that goes back to the idea of, well, yeah, we should worry about this. We need to build in resilience into the infrastructure, make sure we can come back from any kind of a power flux that would disable part of the infrastructure. That's a bipartisan agreement. The challenge is, where's the money? Everybody needs money for Homeland Security, and everybody argues about who should oversee that distribution of money. Should we ask the power companies to chip in and pay for this? That means more fees on the users, and it gets very complicated all of a sudden. Then people say, well, we've got other things to worry about. And I think that's where the bipartisan starts to, ends and the partisanship opens up. We have the more conservative group saying, you don't understand. The terrorists are out there. They're coming after us. If we don't put it in place, we're dead. We're all going to die. We're all going to go back to the dark ages. And there's this hysteria that builds into the discussion that if we don't jump on this now, we're all dooming our society to going back to the Stone Age. And that's just not so. The numbers don't support it. The threat doesn't support it. There are smarter ways to do this. And again, nobody's questioning the EMP technology itself, just that we need to do a smart way to fix this that doesn't necessarily include missile defense in the equation.
Well, if you're going to spend, if you decide not to spend $100 billion or $200 billion on missile defense, what's your projection of the cost of hardening various systems? That's my first part of my question. Second question is it possible, this is from one of the chat room discussions, is it possible to have a smaller scale EMP device that would take out a significant server farm or some smaller chunk of the system and cause significant damage that way.
As far as the infrastructure costs, I have no idea. I'm not an electrical engineer. My business is not in the civilian communication sector. I have no idea what the cost would be. I've seen some articles in the newspaper about the costs of when the system goes down. I think they talked about when Canada had a brownout in a disaster, it cost billions of dollars to replace and bring it back up. I'm sure when we had that the brownout in 2003, was it, that it also cost billions to build up again. And some people argue, well, we need to invest in that so we don't lose that the cost of building it all back up. Absolutely agree. But again, we're not going to fix the communications infrastructure against solar storms or EMP with a missile defense system. What was your second question again? I'm sorry.
Well, it has to do with the possibility of using a smaller device to take
smaller
out.
One.
Yeah, smaller. Well, a portable device that would take out like a big server farm for the infrastructure that supports our internet and stuff like that.
Non-nuclear or nuclear?
Does that matter?
Sure. I think there is. I don't think I can get into specifics for that kind of a discussion, though. It starts getting kind of sensitive. Yes, it's absolutely a possibility. In fact, I would argue, instead of the idea that the entire United States would be knocked out, I would give credence to the idea that in a perfect situation, a terrorist could bring over that nuke and stop 12 miles outside the coast and maybe fire it over the East Coast and maybe just take out a city or two or a state's communication structure. Certainly that would be a lot of damage, and that would be a significant loss of face for the United States, and the terrorists could all dance and enjoy of what happened. Absolutely could happen. Again, I don't think that missile defense system is going to stop that scenario from happening. I don't know if you follow the Missile Defense Agency that much, but they talk about the need to intercept a missile as it initiates in the mid-course when it peaks and then when it's coming down towards the United States. There's different programs for each phase of a missile's trajectory. If somebody just sends up a nuke, a missile from off the coast of the United States over Washington, D.C., it's going to be awfully hard to stop it unless there's an Aegis cruiser sitting right off our coast. And last time I checked, that wasn't really the current status of the U.S. Navy. They didn't believe in guarding right off the coast. That's the Coast Guard that usually does that, and they don't have any missile launchers.
However,
sure,
that would be a great reason to talk some of our major cities into expanding Fleet Week, inviting the sailors in, coming to more than New York City. There you go. Hey, I want to be a mean host, and I'm going to give you about 5 minutes as we get near the bottom of the hour to answer what is probably a five-hour question and answer session. But I want you to put your red hat on, and let's just say for a moment that EMP isn't an option because we couldn't get the warhead. But what I've done is I don't have much money, but I do have access to people. I'm going to give you a cell of 12 exceptionally qualified college-trained engineers and chemists who will do anything you say. I've got an established logistics hub out of Detroit that I've had established for about 7 or 8 years and have never accessed it before. I'm going to give you a budget of $5 million, and I want you to make the biggest impact you can on the continental U.S. on July 4th, 2011. You've got the dozen people, you've got $5 million, you've got the established logistics hub. What would you do to make the biggest impact?
Okay.
I told you I was going to be a mean host.
Okay, yeah. You're putting me on the clock. I got a few minutes here. the thing is, whenever I look at the successful terrorist operations out there, the thing I think that of is high-yield explosives. I'm not going to get sophisticated with chemical weapons or biologicals, only because they're very weather-dependent and they're very quirky in a way. If you don't release them in the right conditions, in the right environment, with a cooperative audience and a cooperative air conditioning system, for instance, they're not going to spread optimally. I'm not going to get a very good kill unless I get like 500 kilograms and able to spray it over a city or something to that effect. And that gets too much interest. So if I want to be a terrorist and I want to be a successful terrorist, what I'm going to do is give them mostly C4 and maybe some hydrochloric acid containers, something simple, and say you're going to go to the major systems in D.C., in New York, in L.A., in Atlanta. I don't know if there's a – well, there's the T system in Chicago, the over transit. And I'm going to say you're going to go to the major transit systems and find out where they overcross. There's a, for instance, in D.C., there's a place where four metro lines come together at Metro Center. I think it's Metro Center. So you're going to go there, plant the explosives, and then a little bit further away from the explosives, the hydrochloric acid, and wait until rush hour that next morning around 5, 6 o'clock in the morning, and blow them all at the same time. And in D.C., Atlanta, L.A., Detroit, Austin, Texas, wherever. And I think the simultaneous attack on the metro stations and transit stations will not cripple the United States, but it's going to cause such fear and such anger against the state governments and the city governments for not protecting the citizens more, that it will cause a major upheaval within the United States and achieve the terrorist goal of showing how powerful they are and how weak the United States is. Now, for 5 minutes, that's all you're going to get. I'm a chem bio expert. I'll just say I'm a chem bio analyst, but my impression is the military knows how to use chem bio much better than the terrorists. Terrorists go with the tried and true explosives and automatic weapons.
Well, Jason, we're coming near the bottom of the hour. First of all, I wanted to thank you very much for coming on MidRats and getting everybody a little bit to think about from perhaps a different angle they haven't before. And once again, if people are interested in reading some more of your thoughts and your point of view on some of our national security issues, where are some good places for them to go to find your work?
Well, really, I just kind of isolate myself on my little blog, and I like to pop around to some of the other national security blogs that are out there. I kind of keep a low profile. I just kind of like to talk casually about some of the issues that are out there. And that would be at the Armchair Generalist. That's all I got.
Okay, great. Well, everybody, head on over to the Armchair Generalist and read more of what Jason has to say. And, Jason, I hope you have a good Halloween.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you, Jason. And I would add that it's good for me to go to your site because every now and then I get spooled up about something, and you do present a different perspective, which I appreciate.
Okay, everybody. And just as a quick reminder, you're listening to Navy Milblog Radio MidRats. I am Sal from the blog Commander Salamander, along with the co-host Eagle One of the blog Eagle Speak. And just as a sidebar, as we're near the bottom of the hour, Eagle One and I, we're also co-bloggers, along with a pretty good stable of people over at the United States Naval Institute. And I just wanted to give a moment to put out there some thanks to the U.S. Naval Institute. Last week, they were kind enough to do a little slumming, and they hosted Eagle One and myself, amongst a few other people, including Galrin from Information Dissemination, X-Formed from Chaotic Synaptic Activity, I think, is where you can find X-Formed, and a few other folks, and really enjoyed. It was a very good presentation. If you haven't had a chance to go over and to the U.S. Naval Institute site and look at some of the things they put on there. I would highly recommend it. A couple of things would be the lunch program, where we had the Senior Vice President from Maersk Lines on, who will also be our guest next week, by the way. And also, there was a very good speech at the awards night that you can find the text of by Admiral Stavridis on the importance of writing and thinking. So again, thanks to the good people over at the Naval Institute for that show. But let's get on to the second half with our guest. He is James Carafano, Ph.D. He is the Deputy Director from the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies and the Director for the Douglas and Sarah Allison Center for Foreign Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. He's also an author. His most recent book is Private Sector Public Wars, Contractors in Combat, Afghanistan, Iraq, and the Future Conflicts. It's a study of the contractors' role in the battlefield and their impact on military effectiveness in civil society. He also has an ongoing book project that he's husbanding on the history of modern military. He's the editor of this new book series called The Changing Faces of War. And you can find links to both of these things over at my home blog at Commander Salamander if you'd like to dig into those and look at them a little further. Jim joined Heritage as a senior research fellow in 2003, and he has been a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a Washington Policy Institute dedicated to defense issues. He's a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel, where he served in Europe, Korea, and here in the U.S. His assignments included the head speechwriter for the Army Chief of Staff. He also, before retiring, he was executive editor of Joint Force Quarterly, the Defense Department's premier professional military journal. And Jim, welcome to MidRaps.
Hey, it's good to be with you.
Excellent. And hope you're having a good Halloween so far. And what is a little uncharacteristically for me, I'm going to keep things short. And I want to start off with you, the same question I did with our previous guest. From your point of view, if you could, for our listeners, describe to us what is the threat from electromagnetic pulse. And as the discussion goes on in the national security arena here in the U.S., what are most people getting right about discussing it? And where are people really missing it and getting the conversation wrong?
Well, you know, there are two aspects to this threat. One which doesn't get as mentioned nearly as much, which is the natural occurrence of this, which is there are periods in Earth's history when you have extreme intense bursts of solar flares. The last one was back in the 19th century, and it was documented by an astronomer named Carrington. It's called the Carrington effect. And during these periods, the radiation is so incredibly intense. And, of course, we don't notice it because you don't see radiation, you don't feel it. Back then, the only way they knew about it was the telegraph lines, because, electromagnetic energy is looking for something to ground it. It's looking for an antenna to suck it into it. And back then, really before the world was electrified, the only thing there were telegraph lines. And so there were cases worldwide of telegraph operators being knocked off their chairs, and the paper tapes that the telegraph would record the Morse code on catching fire and burning down telegraph offices. That's the last period in our history where we've had that kind of phenomenon. And one thing that, quite honestly, is something to worry about is, you know, they say this happens at 50-100-year intervals. Sometime again, we're going to get a burst of solar radiation from the sun that's similar, and now the world's electrified. So all the world's electrical systems will be like giant antennas, really sucking in this like a giant tsunami of energy. And so that's something to be concerned about. And of course, the primary concern that we have is the man-made, the most devastating of which is a nuclear burst. We don't normally think of the electromagnetic pulse effects, because militarily, the way you normally target nuclear weapons is what's called a low air burst, which is it's low enough to the ground that you feel the entire concussive effects of the explosion on the surface of the Earth. But the electromagnetic pulse, most of it is driven directly into the ground, and the systems that would normally be affected by it are also kind of burned up, so you really don't notice that. But we know that if you do this at a high altitude, and both the Russians and the U.S. have done this, because back in the 50s, we both did high-altitude airbursts, the radiation just radiate outward. And so if you have a large nuclear weapon and it's detonated at a high altitude, expect everything from satellites in low Earth orbit to electrical systems on the ground. And one of the perverse things about modern electrical systems is we're driving towards less and less and less and less power to drive our electrical systems. But what that means is the microchips that are funneling through these electrical circuits, they're more and more vulnerable to being overloaded. And so the great danger, of course, is that major electrical systems and often what's called SCADA, which are the command and control systems that control utilities, electrical systems, that these would burn out. And the problem is everything that's dependent on them, transportation networks, traffic light systems, water pumping stations, sewage, the electrical systems, the emergency systems, they would all be gone. And not only would they be gone, reconstituting them would be incredibly difficult. And by some estimates, a lot of people would die, not because you're injured in any way, but you would have fires and other incidents that you couldn't respond to. And then people would just suffer from exposure and lack of food because you couldn't move things around enough. So this, in a sense, is a true genocidal weapon. I mean, if you took the United States, in a sense, back to the 19th century, the difference is we didn't have 300 million people back then, and back then people could grow their own food and take care of themselves in a way that they can't now. So our population is extremely vulnerable to the catastrophic loss of the electrical systems and the other electrical systems that we use every day to meet our everyday basic needs.
Well, there have been some suggestions that given the level of risk involved, that spending several hundreds of billions of dollars to harden our systems or otherwise prevent the effects of an EMP, whether it's a natural solar flare or man-made, is hard to justify, and that some people are saying that really this is more of a military, if you will, the old military-industrial complex approach to let's spend more money on defense, even though the risk is really remote.
First of all, I'd reject the notion that it would cost $700 billion to defend against this. And I would also say, look, the sun is going to do this to us someday anyway. I mean, you may not believe in the military threat at all, but this is going to happen, just like someday there's going to be a massive earthquake that's going to dump California into the ocean. I mean, these are things that are just going to happen. Now, what we tend to do is ignore them because we call them black swans, and this is an ancient concept that really goes back to the Greeks, where they would say, an honest Greek is about as common as a black swan, in a sense we don't see this. And what happens was centuries later, when Europeans actually got going around the world, they went to Australia and they found out, oh my God, there are a lot of black swans. And so these are problems where things that are difficult or we don't want to think about them or we think they're not going to happen, so we push them off to the side and say, let's just not think about that. It's never going to happen. And so that simply what we're doing is treating this as a black swan problem. It's going to happen someday. And ignoring it doesn't lessen the risk. But this notion it's going to cost billions of dollars is, I think, people think you've got to harden every electrical system in the country. And that's, I think, first of all, very untrue. First of all, early warning would make a big difference. It takes 30 minutes for a missile to get anywhere in the world towards the United States. It also takes about 30 minutes for the solar radiation to get from the sun to the earth. So even if you just had 15 minutes warning time, you could shut off some key electrical systems. And in the sense that they're turned off, they're going to be not affected by this at all. So early warning is something that we could utilize, which would affect risk. And there are some things you can do with hardening. There's new technologies are evolving. I think there's a bunch of ways to deal with this at the $100 billion level that would significantly increase the resiliency of our society. And the other thing I would say is, look, we cannot afford to live without the electrical grid in this country. I mean, this country cannot survive. It is the key linchpin. We just did a study of this at Heritage and looked at a whole range of disasters. It's actually a very interesting study. It'll be out fairly soon. We looked at really big disasters like Katrina and the earthquake in Haiti and major electrical blackouts in the United States, some of which in different ways have things that are similar to, not exactly like, but similar to an EMP. And we, you know, said, what are the lessons learned on this? And one of the lessons learned is no matter what kind of disaster you look at, you cannot survive for long without reconstituting the electrical grid. There are some things that we could focus on. There are some low-cost things that we could do. There are some planning things that we could do. But ignoring it and doing nothing is pretty penny-wise and incredibly pound-foolish.
Something you brought up a couple of times is the naturally occurring EMP threat that you can get from the sun and the solar flares. I think you said every 150 years, I think this goes on. And
something like that.
Right, and what that brings to mind is anybody who happened to experience the great northeastern blackout a few years back, I don't think are Pollyannish enough to think that industry invests properly in infrastructure in order to make sure we have a robust system. Now, all that being said, if you were going to develop a program, for instance, you know, the science got to the point that industry said, yeah, we need to mitigate this threat. I think you mentioned $200 billion, but is industry looking at this seriously? And if they did, and there were some public-private partnership to at least defend against a naturally occurring EMP, how much of the protection that you would get against a expected severe solar flare has a crossover positive effect to defend against a medium-yield EMP-type attack?
Well, that's just one for one. I mean, if you're defending against a solar flare, you basically have an EMP defense, period. So there's a direct correlation there. But I would say you're basically looking at the resilience of the major electrical systems in the country, whether it's the grid or the internet or something else. And, you know, there are payoff things in terms of these, some of the things that you would do that are going to help you out in terms of any kind of large-scale disaster, whether it's a hurricane or a major failure in the grid or something else. And, you know, there's a range of mitigation techniques. I mean, sometimes you have replacements. Sometimes you have protection. Sometimes you have early warning. And the trick is to look at the best combination of defenses so you get the most resiliency for the least cost. You know, some of that public, some of that private, absolutely. You know, I tend to believe in the free market and the ability of the free market to really do the right thing in many, many ways and develop that new technologies. There's a lot of work going on. You know, as there's a thing called Moore's Law, which everybody's kind of familiar with, which is that the capacity of the computer chip just kind of doubles every certain number of years. And everybody realizes that there's an end to Moore's Law. One is it's just the thickness of light getting through these little pathways in the silicon chips. But the other one is the thermal management, because when you get to very, very small densities, managing it, the smaller you go, the more you have to worry about the heat. And so thermal management becomes very, very important in these hyper-efficient silicon chips. And dealing with thermal management also helps us think a lot about the overloading and electrical overloads. So there's interesting work going on in nanoelectronics and other things, which is going to pay some big dividends to us. This work's going on regardless of whether people are worried about EMP or not. So here's the thing is I think there's actually research and technology out there. People may not be developing it because they're worried about EMP threats, but it has a lot of application to EMP. And so in some ways, some of these electrical problems, some of these defenses are going to get developed just because of people developing new technologies. I don't think there is necessarily you need a Manhattan Project here and that government needs to tell the private sector what needs to be done. But I think there are some key points that on the public side and the private side we could develop actually some fairly robust, more resilient infrastructure without, in a sense, throwing a ton of money at this problem. The problem is we're just not paying attention to it. I think if we paid attention to it, we could have developed a lot more things. Of course, in Washington, the problem is sometimes you don't want Washington to pay attention to a problem because their answer is just throw a lot of money at it and be incredibly inefficient. So,
well, one of the recent books was 1 Second After, I guess, which is a
right.
You know, and I gather that it's called some attention to this, but it looks to me like Congress has been meeting on the EMP issue since about 1997. Is there a way for this to gain more traction? Is it a matter of education and people like yourself continue to write op-ed pieces about it?
I mean, I think there's zero movement on this. I mean, in part, sadly, this has almost become a partisan issue, which is, you know, much in the way missile defense back in the Reagan era was a partisan issue, which, of course, is nonsense. I mean, the enemies don't have politics. I mean, you know, Al-Qaeda, the Russians, the Iran, China, I mean, they don't care if the West Wing is run by the right wing or the left wing, right? But unfortunately, I think that in order to kind of dismiss this threat, you know, people just say, well, that's just something that the other side wants because, you know, whatever. So that really, in a sense, has greatly poisoned the well. I mean, there have been hearings on the Hill where not one Democratic member would show up. You know, that's pretty disappointing. I have found zero interest in either the Congress or the administration on this. I find nobody in Homeland Security has taken this seriously. Nobody in the Department of Defense that's really interested in this. Everybody wants to treat this like a black swan.
Yeah, with our previous guest, I actually brought up that question about, you know, what if there is a bipartisan consensus on this threat, if for no other reason, that when you rack and stack your threats versus the money you have to address them, what the best way to mitigate, you can only effectively do that if you have a good conversation going, what I like to call creative friction. And if you don't have people willing to come into the table, you're not going to get a bipartisan consensus. And something that's really important all of a sudden just becomes another damn partisan issue, so you can't actually
right.
resolve anything. Let me let's put on our little red hats here for a minute. Because I know a lot of times when people talk about the threat of a terrorist EMP attack, you know, you have the, you know, let's have the big given that they actually have a weapon that can do it. So we're going to just assume that
right.
they do. But I think another big problem, mostly because of the fact that more likely to get intel tipper, it's the access to ballistic missiles, transporting ballistic missiles,
right.
servicing them, doing the maintenance. And, you know, there's a common slide out there that talks about, you know, EMP area by burst at 30, 120, and 300 miles,
right.
centered somewhere in Kansas, and that's good from a conversation point, but put on a red hat and doing something more practical. Two things come to mind. One, if you're going to do a terrorist attack, I think there were very good, logical, and operationally sound reasons why it was New York City and Washington, D.C. that were attacked on 9/11. So let's go ahead and make the D.C., New York City corridor there, and I think you can put, if that's a red spot, put a little pink spot over Chicago and L.A., because maximum impact, that's the places where the people in Karachi who watch TV, they hear the name of that city, they understand it. And if you're not going to have that type of ballistic missile, but you really want to have a good impact, you've got to get some altitude. And I think that's actually the easiest thing
right.
for the people to do, because it's very easy to set up a private cargo company. And if you just get your
right.
standard issue Learjet 45, it has
right.
a ceiling of 51,000 feet. That's 9.65 miles. That's
right.
not ideal. But in weaponeering, there is something called good enough. So if you take that $200 billion figure you gave us before, and let's say because
right.
the budgetary pressures we're going to have over the next decade are going to bust people's balls left, right, and sideways. So you're not going to be able to do what you want to do. You've got to mitigate. So if you were going to say, we're just going to try to cover our most likely targets, the D.C. to New York City corridor, and we'll throw some love at the West Coast for L.A., and then we'll get to Chicago when we can. Has there been a look of how much it would take just to cover your high-value targets first?
Well, no, you know, and I would, you know, actually, you know, my argument is I would approach this from an all-hazards perspective. There's lots of reasons to build resiliency into these systems for a whole range of reasons, not just EMP and solar flares. And so I think you can actually build a case that were some defenses. Now, you know, and the other course is if you're worried about, I mean, there are some things you can do in terms of air security, in terms of controlling your airspace, right? So the other option is the missile option, right? And, you know, of course, you know, one of the arguments about missile defense is that the interceptor doesn't care, right? It doesn't care if it's going to be an EMP burst. It doesn't care if it's going to be aimed at a city in a low-altitude air burst. It doesn't care if the cargo is a nuclear weapon or a biological weapon or a chemical weapon. It's going to shoot down the missile. And so I'm obviously a strong advocate for missile defense because I think that covers a wealth of ills. The scenario that worries me the most is not necessarily the terrorist scenario, but it's the state actor who wants a decapitation option, and one in which they can have plausible deniability. And of course, with a missile, with a weapon on an aircraft, you know, proof to where the plane came from. And of course, the other is a seaborne launch, which, you know, same thing, you know, scuttle the ship and then prove where that came from. So, and this, to me, gets to the thing about people say, well, who would do this and why would they do this? You know, there could be a time when an enemy might say, look, you know, this is the best of the bad options. We're going to do a decapitation too. One that gets me is, look, if I had one nuclear weapon, I probably had two nuclear weapons. And if I was going to attack the United States, I wouldn't do just an EMP attack. You know, I would drop a nuclear weapon on New York, and I would drop a nuclear weapon with an EMP attack, and then try to deal with a catastrophe of a nuclear weapon detonating over a city when you don't have communications, an electrical grid, or anything else. I mean, that, in a sense, America would be just prostrate, period.
What is there a connection? I know that Heritage Foundation put out the movie 33 Minutes.
Right.
What connection do you put between that movie and your EMP discussion?
Well, there is a section in the film that talks about EMP, and it's incredibly powerful. And for me, the most chilling moment in the film is actually very interesting. Is we interviewed Bill Graham. Bill Graham was the science advisor to President Reagan. Was very much involved with the SDI project from the beginning. He's a brilliant scientist. And he was also one of the chairs of the last congressional commission that looked at EMP. And so we interviewed Bill out at his home in California, mostly on missile defense. And then we kind of got into EMP at the end. And, you know, we were kind of done. And, you know, since we went all the way out there to California to interview him, we just wanted to make sure we got the thing. So we're just sitting there trying to think of questions to throw at him. And then one of our producers just said, well, what would the world be like if an EMP went off? And, you know, Bill went into this discussion of, you know, think as if we're back in the 19th century, but now you've got 300 million people, and it is just the most chilling thing you've ever heard. It's, to me, it's more chilling than reading the book One Second After or seeing something. It's just an incredible scene to be thinking of. And by the way, you know, if people want more information on the documentary, they can just go to the website, which is 33, and then the word minute. So it's 33minutes.com, and they can find out about the film and get more information on EMP and other things as well.
Hey, something else to look at here, going from the macro to the micro. As one retired 05 to another, one thing that, you know, back when we were young pups, it was a given when we trained to operate in a nuclear environment, and everything
right.
was EMP hardened. And, you know, even in the Navy hasn't completely forgot about that, is the fact that for our Aegis Air Defense System, NAVC has already bumped up the amount of HIMP protection that we're expected to have,
right.
And you can go online and find details about that. But since you and I were young pups after we got our commission to today, the Navy and the military in general has moved on to, you know, commercial off the shelf, COTS technology, getting as much as they can. So our ships and our army is just laden with this stuff that has no protection whatsoever. how much concern do you see that in, you know, you talk about black swans, everybody thinks asymmetrical. Well, here's the black swan that sometime in the next couple of decades, somebody decides they do want to go a conventional conflict with us. Is there an appreciation for the amount of vulnerability our military force, forget the civilian, our military forces in the field and at sea are to an EMP attack right now?
No. Matter of fact, when we built the ground-based mid-course interceptor system in Alaska and California, they are not EMP hardened, which is pretty stunning. Generally, again, the military doesn't want to talk about this because it costs them more money. So it is the black swan. They kind of push it off to the side. But it's not just the military. Most people don't realize, half of the world's intellectual capital is housed in the United States. Countries from around the world take their information and they secure it and put it here. With a major EMP attack, and people talk about the megaton thing over the Kansas, right? But it doesn't have to be that. I mean, even if you had the smaller yields over the Northeast, the cascading effect of that would be just as devastating. The entire world would probably sink back into the next dark ages. If you took the U.S. economy out of the picture, that is a global risk. And by the way, if there are any Canadians listening, the economies of Canada and the infrastructure of Canada and the United States are so tied into each other that if there's an attack on the United States, essentially it's an attack on Canada. And if you think, taking care of Americans would be tough. You look at the size of Canada, taking care of that population would be virtually impossible. So, U.S. and Canada are kind of in this together. I found it actually very kind of troubling that Canadians have kind of tried to not want to be involved terribly in missile defense, whereas, they've got just as big a dog in the fight on this as we do.
And I think we have enough time for one more quick question. Eagle One, what you got?
Well, I was going to... Now, you've written a number of articles on this particular topic of EMP. Do you have some place you direct people where they could find out more about your writing on the subject?
Yeah, and actually, like I said, my favorite paper on this is the one that isn't out yet. It's where we kind of did a survey on major disasters in recent history and what lessons they tell us for thinking about dealing with an EMP threat. That'll be out pretty soon. It's done with a co-author, Richard Weiss, from the Hudson Institute. But the great thing about Heritage is all our material is, Heritage is a very transparent place. All our information, all our material is open to the public, and it's all retained on the website, which is www.heritage.org. So if you go to heritage.org and you just go to the search engine and type in EMP or my name or missile defense, and it's pretty easy to find all the information. And we have written a lot on this over the years. I'm very proud of the work that we have done. And the fact that we're one of the few major think tanks that gives this issue the seriousness that it deserves.
And on that note, I think we've pretty much run out of time, and I wanted to thank everybody.
Piccadilly.